Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Can you sort of talk us through the kind of average, like, night shift? Because I remember you sort of saying there was a break and you'd have like a packet of crisps and that would do you for the whole evening or something like that. Yeah. Just sort of the stuff you told me, basically.
You'd come onto the ward about 8:45 at night, and your handover from the day staff was 9 till 9:15. There would be three of you. There would be the nurse in charge, there would be an enrolled nurse and a student or an auxiliary. If you were very, very busy, you might have a bank nurse, which is a nurse who would just be a nurse who comes to do a few hours, who's just directed to any ward where it's needed. So they'd go off and do that. I'd go check all the patients, check their fluid sheets to make sure that they have enough intravenous fluid written up for the night, if they have it for the night. Get the drugs trolley out, and you go through with the drugs trolley while your other nurses are going through sort of the temperature, pulse, blood pressure, settling people down for the night. And you would go through, if anyone needed a hand, well, you'd go and give them a hand. And then you have your big notepad for the night, and you'd write anything down, and then by the time you'd finished, that, you know, you hopefully your doctor is still around, your houseman, and you get them to make sure there's enough fluid for the night, anybody who's needing extra drugs for the night that they've got them, anyone who's got a temperature, anything abnormal, you just report to the doctor for the night. And as you're going along, you switch the lights out and just make sure everybody's comfortable for the night. And then by that time, it's usually time for one of the nurses to go for their break. and then next one comes back. I would nearly always take a third break, which was, would have been about 1 o'clock in the morning or something like that. And you might have a sandwich and a cup of coffee then. Sometimes I'd go down to the canteen. When I first did nights, you used to have the whole canteen open. You could get bacon sandwiches and all sorts. You could get a dinner if you wanted. Why you would feel like eating a dinner at that time, and I really don't know. But then by the time I was qualified, it had got that you had machines and you could get some chips out the machine, or there was these microwavable meals that you just put in a microwave. Oh, they were horrible. So you tended to take your packed lunch. Sometimes, depending on how busy we were, sometimes I would just stay on the ward, just go into the day room and eat it there. And then 2 o'clock, you did your 2 o'clock rounds where you go and check all the patients. When I first did nights, you used to have to go around and check all pulses, temperatures, blood pressures and things. But then they got it that, well, you only checked the really sick ones, or if anyone was having bother. I mean, obviously, if there was other people who were really sick, it wouldn't just be 2 o'clock in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning. You would go and check them a bit more often. But yes, 2 o'clock, you would go and do your rounds, just go, you know, make sure every single person is checked. And 6 o'clock in the morning as well. In between that time, you all have about another 20-minute break. Usually, I would just go in the day room, Mars bar, bag of crisps, cup of coffee. That was my usual thing at 5 o'clock in the morning. And because I had to write up the notes, because every patient should have a care plan, and then in the file, every patient has their Cardex, I think it was called Cardex. And you would write down sort of what sort of a night they had, if there was any problems, and that's what the day staff have to go by. And the day staff would come on at about 7:30 to have a handover. And I would just be me handing over to the day staff, just telling them what's happened overnight, if they've had a good night, and that would be it. My real sort of annoyance with night duty was when the clocks go forward and the clocks go back. Because when the clocks go back and the day staff lose an hour's sleep, you could guarantee they'd be late coming in.
Yeah, well, I mean,
if I got this the right way around now, if the clocks go back, yeah, I think that's when they used to come in late. Because if you did when the clocks went back, you were supposed to do the shift where the clocks went forward, so you didn't actually lose an hour out of your life.
Okay.
I'm sure that's happened to me somewhere along the line. But yeah, it was supposed to be that they should come in at the normal time, but they never did. So the times when it should have been advantageous to us, it never was, because it would come in late.
So I kind of just want to touch on your work with the few asthma and diet studies that you've done.
Okay,
I was expecting that reaction. I won't get into it too much because I know you've probably talked about it to death with people who are far more qualified to talk about it than me.
Well, I got into asthma. I did some research in Newcastle with a chap called David Hendrick, and it was the time asthma prevalence was shooting up. In the UK, asthma prevalence shot up in the 1970s and 80s. You know, kids with asthma went from 4% to 24% over the space of 20, 30 years. Mm-hmm. And everybody was trying to find out why this had happened. So when I did some research in Newcastle, and we were looking at prevalence of asthma in the East Coast and West Coast, which is why you spent the first year or two of your life being transported between the East Coast and the West Coast. So we used to go across the West Coast every couple of weeks, and you used to be chucked in the back of the car. So anyway, so you spent most of your first year. So we used to see patients and study recruits and things like that. And I used to take you into work, and you used to get shoved on the floor in the pulmonary function lab on Saturday mornings, whereas patients came in to be reviewed. Anyway, so then we did a study where we were looking at sodium excretion, looking at sodium intake in people. Mm-hmm. And one of the best ways to look at sodium intake in relation to asthma was we used to collect the urine for 24 hours. So these people used to collect their urine for 24 hours and leave it on our doorstep in Whitehaven. So we used to
wake up in the morning.
Yes, so we used to wake up in the morning with milk on the doorstep as well as 2 liter bottles of urine. Anyway, so then I went to Nottingham and wrote up my research, and then I went up to Aberdeen to work with a chap called Anthony Seaton, who'd come up with this idea that maybe diet had something to do with asthma. So between the two of us, we came with this idea that maybe diet during pregnancy was important. So we set up this study of, birth cohort, looking at what mothers ate during pregnancy and related it to what their whether children developed asthma or not. And we showed lots of interesting associations. And people have now done intervention studies with things like vitamin D and fatty acids and shown that indeed, if you give pregnant women certain things, you can alter the kid's risk of developing asthma.
Okay.
So that's what we did. And we've done lots of other things looking at maternal occupation, maternal smoking. I mean, the really interesting thing is you can actually look at ultrasound scans of babies at 10 weeks gestation, and babies who develop asthma are a little bit smaller at 10 weeks. And then we know that if you've got reduced lung function when you're born, you're more likely to have reduced lung function when you're about 20, 30. If you've got reduced lung function when you're a kid, you're more likely to develop asthma, you're more likely to develop COPD as an adult. So it looks very much as though kids are programmed to develop airways disease, and that, you know, once you're on this trajectory towards asthma and COPD, you know, your increased susceptibility and other things take effect. So this is what we've been working on for the last sort of 20 years, this idea that what happens to you before you're born influences whether you like to develop asthma or COPD later in life. So that's what we've been up to.
So you had a week in school more or less preparing you for psychiatric wards. So I was at, I think it was St. Nicholas's in Gosforth, which was like a very old Victorian building. Mm. Yeah, it wasn't a very nice building, you know, very clinical looking inside, white tiles and things, very cold looking when you go in. When I think of it, I just think of it sort of the darkness and the foreboding every time you went in that building. Yeah, it was, you think of people with mental health and psychiatric problems, but I don't know, I suppose it was still quite, a lot of this stuff was old fashioned. I don't know how they deal with it even these days, but I can't imagine that a lot of the things that way some of them were, well, they were treated, I'm not saying they were treated badly or anything, but I don't know how it would have changed now, but I just remember the foreboding and the very sort of clinical and, One thing, I think they still do it, the electric shock treatment. And it's an absolutely barbaric thing to see. And I remember there was an elderly patient and he was in with depression, a lovely old man. And he had to go for some more electric shock treatment and he really didn't want it. And I had to take him down and I felt awful. Mm. And I had to stay with him. And it was just heartbreaking. You know, because I knew he didn't want it. And I know afterwards he would have some bad effects. And, you know, he had memory problems and things when he came round from it. And, things like that I just thought was barbaric. And I just remember, you know, patients probably still do wander the wards and the corridors like they did then. And, you know, people where, you know, they can see parts of their body. I think it was mainly hearts. I don't know why hearts, but mainly hearts sort of beating on the ground in the corridor, and they would be so, oh, you can't stand there. And so quite shocking. And then we had the escapees. I don't know how they used to escape.
I was going to ask about the escapees because I remember you talking about somebody escaping and you had to go chasing them.
Yeah, it was a young lass. Luckily, I was quite young then and fit. she was on sort of close monitoring. So you had this nursing station and then you had beds that were sort of right in front of the glass. But there was like a curtain, like a net curtain. But, you could still see them. But so they felt as if they had some privacy. And there was a young lass and I can't remember what she was actually in for, but, you know, she was always running across the blooming field out of this hospital because there was quite a huge grounds to this hospital and you ended up sort of shooting after it because it was always the first one who spotted it had to go. You couldn't just sort of wait around and say, well, hang on, you know, can someone go after it? You had to go. And it was charging over this field and then, you know, not trying to grab a hold of her, but, you know, sort of try and get in front of her or something and tell her to, you know, she has to go back. But yes, I did quite a lot of running. I don't know how she used to get out, quite honestly. I can't remember. My brain just doesn't go that far back and think, oh, yeah, I remember that. That's how it happened. But somehow she used to manage to get out. So yeah, I just remember running over that field across this young lass, very tall, thin young girl with blonde hair. I remember that.
Darting across a field.
Darting wow. across a field.
I was going to touch on your work in Africa a little bit later, but I guess we can talk about it now. So, like, is it the same thing you're doing in Africa, or is it something slightly different?
It's taking the ideas that people have developed in what they call the global north, which is Europe, Australia, and America, but they're far more relevant to the global south, such as Asia, Africa, where nutrition is less stable, more people are likely to be short of food, and it's very clear, almost certainly, most of the lung prevalence of lung disease in Africa is appalling. Their lung function is appalling. However, it looks very much as though most of it is related to things happening to them before they're born, what the mother eats, where she's exposed to smoke, all sorts of things. But it looks as though as much of the lung disease present in Africa is related to what happens to babies before they're born. It's very much what was happening in Glasgow, Liverpool, Newcastle at the turn of the 19th century into the 20th century. So lots of kids born who'd been short of food before they were born, born with poor lungs, you know, then they started smoking, highly likely to develop COPD and asthma. So what we're seeing in Africa now is what we were seeing in the UK at the beginning of the 20th century. So it's all linked in.
I just think feeling that you were doing something for somebody else, that they needed you and you were making their life a little bit better, whether they were actually going to be getting better and going home or weren't expected to get better, you were making a difference to their lives by talking to them, by being happy that they would see smiley face, somebody who would sit and chat to them, you know, who they trusted. And it was just really, I think that's what you get out of it, that you see that you're helping somebody that can't help themselves. And then of course there was the, when I first qualified and went on to ward 15, and the enrolled nurse and auxiliary didn't know who they were getting in charge of the ward that night, and I walked on the ward, and I'd already worked with the auxiliary when I was a third year student on night duty, and she says, it's Jill, we'll be fine. Yay. That was the thing. It was always a proud moment as a student if you were trusted to go and do something on your own, or if you were trusted to stay in charge of the ward while the one in charge had gone off for a break or something. That was always a... Oh, you always wanted to carry the drug keys. You always wanted to be the one clattering the keys in your pocket. It made you feel important. That was always the goal of a student nurse, to be able to walk around with keys. Especially the control drug key, that was even better.
And then when
you're allowed to take the phone for the whole of the medical unit, that was even better. Sorry, just these little moments.
What's this? Oh, I've been sent something.
Was it me sending you the Zoom link by any chance?
No, it's it's another one of my pop songs from Africa.
Actually, you know what? We're here now. You brought it up. We're going to talk about it. So you sent me a music video. You sent me a message a while ago saying you're now a pop producer, and you sent me a music video. Do you want to talk about that on here?
Yeah, what we're doing is. So soon after I got to school of tropical medicine, we managed to get this grant to look at lung health in Kenya. So what we're doing is we're looking at the lung health of children who live in two communities in Nairobi and Kenya. So one of the communities is in a slum called Mukuru. So it's a huge slum, you know, 300,000 people living in really crowded conditions. And then there's a slightly more upmarket area called Buruburu. So what we're doing is we're going to the schools and recruiting the children and recruiting in both schools and recruiting the parents, and we're getting questionnaires and we're measuring the kids' lung function. Mm. When you're in Africa, it's really important, because in the UK, if you want to do research, just send them a letter. Whereas in Africa, they're a little bit more wary about these sorts of things. And what you try and do is to get the whole community involved.
Okay.
So we have some researchers in Glasgow who are very good at getting communities involved. So what's happened is they've got all these community groups in Buruburu and Makuru, and the people who live in the area have generated a pop song to publicize the study. When you look at the pop video, it's all about Tupumui, which is Let's Breathe, and that's the name of the study. And they've got Ishifiti, which is Live Long, you know, Breathe Well, Live Long. So they had a big march between the communities of Makuru and Buruburu, which is what you see on the pop video. So the pop video is there to advertise the study. So they're all wearing Tupumui t-shirts. It's all about advertising the study. There's now a Tupumui channel on YouTube. So it's all about trying to get people involved, and, you know, some they like pop videos, and it's a way of getting them involved in the study. So that, you know, the kids are all involved because there's a puppet and they love puppets. So it's all about trying to get them enthused about it. So that's why there's a video. And I coughed up the cash to pay for it.
Excellent. Well, I will put a link to the project in the show notes for the episode, so people can can look it up and do a little bit of promo for it as well. Excellent. Well, yeah. Okay. That I promise that is everything now. So thank you.
Good. Right. I'll get your mum on board. Okay.
Excellent. No worries.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Before we get into the episode today, I want to give a quick shout out to Twin Strangers Productions and their sci-fi horror adventure audio drama, Syntax, the fourth season of which is coming soon. Syntax is a fantastic show that smashes together science fiction, cryptids, speculative biology, and my personal favorite, linguistics. It follows the story of Silas as he works to translate an ancient text, hoping to find clues that will help his team of six understand the mystery of the breaches. If you enjoy Annihilation, as in the book, not the concept in general, or the Stargate TV series, I think you'll really love this story. Season 4 of Syntax is releasing in April 2024, making it the perfect time to start listening. Syntax is streaming now on all major podcast platforms. Visit syntaxpodcast.com, that's Syntax Podcast, all one word, for more information. Know the depths. Wish for more.